This thing works very good, but I could almost set it down.
No.
Let me see. Yeah, I did. It's working good. I hate carrying one. My name's Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I don't want to do it. That's the whole thing. I don't want to. That was my battle cry. I'm a little scattered at the moment. I was just sitting there thinking about my mother. My mother just died, and she was like the Grand Dame of Al-Anon in West Texas. And this is my first year since she started planting Big Book literature everywhere that I just celebrated 38 years. And and I was just missing. Anyway, I'm Danny. I'm an alcoholic. I've had the gift of sobriety since February the 18th of 81. And I'm very, very happy. It only took me 42 years to get 38. I got here. I have a been around date. You know, I came into Alcoholics Anonymous, but, you know, doing sobriety just all the time was too stressful. So I liked AA, you know, I liked to come, but I'd have to have a break.
And,
can I just, maybe I can stick it in my... Hold the mic up. Why don't you move up closer? What's your name? Exactly. That's why I wasn't holding the mic right. So anyway, hi. And there's a guy waving at me back there. Anyway, my name's Danny still. I forgot where I was. Is that good? Yeah, apparently. I bent the microphone, I think. Anyway, I'm from the Cypresswood group that meets in Spring, Texas. We're a three legacy group. We don't believe that AA just occurs inside the meetings, that you like really need to go out into the community and attempt to carry the message. Although we do like to sit and impress each other, you know. We like to go to other places, learn stuff, come back and repeat it like we figured it out. So when I'm talking, if you've heard that before, it's because that's kind of where I picked it all up. Anything that I have to say, it's worth saying. I've learned from you guys. I told Kathy earlier that for me, AA has been monkey see, monkey do. And the problem is for me, initially I didn't hang out with the right ones. I found a good sponsor and a good group, and they started to train me in the things that I really needed to know. And I didn't think so. I didn't want to be trained. I just wanted money. I was in a lot of trouble. I came to Alcoholics Anonymous in 1979. I was living in an old beat up stolen car. It was a terrible car. The guy didn't even want it back. And I was wearing an eye patch. There was nothing wrong with my eye. I just thought I looked really cool, you know. I was on my fourth marriage, and she had a boyfriend, and that was just creating a lot of trouble for us. I'd been out of prison for a couple of years, and things were just not going well. I got out of prison. I had made myself a promise that when I got out of prison the second time, I said, I am never drinking whiskey again, except on special occasions. And it turns out getting out of prison is a very special occasion. I wound up coming to Alcoholics Anonymous. I was on my way back to prison. I had hot checks out everywhere. I had hepatitis. My liver was swollen. I was just a wreck. I had a 3-year run. I would go 3 years and then I'd go to prison, or I'd go get locked up in some sort of institution. And you know, I was nearing the 3-year mark. You know what happens? It just over and over and over. You know, it's just like Groundhog Day. But my mother had found Alcoholics Anonymous. She found Al-Anon, and apparently they started praying for me. But All I know is that my wife and I were out drinking one day, riding around that park, trying to solve our family problems. Her boyfriend being the biggest one I can think of. And she just pulled up in front of this nondescript looking building in Midland, Texas. I mean, it's a gray building. It had a circle with a triangle on it, you know. And it said 710 Ohio Street. And she just stopped the car and said, "Get out." And I was too weak to resist. So I got out of the car. She drove off. And this was before cell phones. And so I was going to go into that building and use the phone and call a friend and save my marriage. And I stuck my head in the door to see if they'd let me use the phone. And there were some people sitting over in the corner, and they were playing cards and smoking and drinking coffee. And they saw me. They were very happy to see me. I kept trying to ask to use the phone, and they would say things like, "If you don't drink, you won't get drunk." And after a while, I said, "You know, I think you're right. Not sure where we're going with that, but I could like to use the phone if it's possible." And, you know, just, if you don't know our lingo or what we're leading up to, it's kind of, we're a strange bunch. But they said, "Well, if you'll stay for our meeting, we'll give you a ride afterwards." So I thought, well, I don't really have a lot of choice. I was pretty sick. And so I sat through that meeting, and they had call-up meetings. You know, they were the big, huge red rostrum, and they'd people walk up behind it, and whatever they would say, the worse it was, the better you liked it. And I listened to one guy, I don't even remember what he said, but I heard what he said, and I thought, oh, I don't think I'd have got up and told that's not going to win you anything. But everybody just clapped, and when that meeting was over, they all held hands and said the Lord's Prayer. And this was during the days when they had smoking. And you could just look out, and all you could see was legs. You know, it's just a haze out there. And everybody's in a good mood, and they're just laughing and cutting up. And I don't know when it had happened to me, but all my life, I'd get around people, and I would just, in just a very short period of time, my head would start racing, and my foot would start patting, and I'd think, I got to go. I don't know where I gotta go. I don't know why I don't even know where I'm going, but I can't stay here. I gotta go. And I mean, that started happening, and they're all getting circling up to pray, and I'm not a praying guy, you know. I mean, I just gotta go. And they had a back door out the kitchen, and I started backing up towards that door, and it seemed to me that that place parted like the Red Sea. And here come this little short. This little short guy, very dour-looking person, and he had a flat top, and a young guy with him. They were headed right straight towards me. And I saw him, and I said, "Oh, hell no, I ain't going anywhere with him." And he walked up to me, and he said, "Welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. We're going to Baskin-Robbins for ice cream. Would you like to go?" And I thought, Baskin-Robbins for ice cream, be still my beating heart. There is no way on God's green earth that I'm going to go off with a bunch of geriatrics for ice cream while my wife is out with her boyfriend. That ain't happening. But what came out of my mouth is, sure, I'd love to go. So we end up over at Baskin-Robbins holding a melting Rocky Road ice cream while you pitch me on Alcoholics Anonymous on sobriety. And I remember, you know, showing back up multiple times. I always come in, I want to know if you think I'm an alcoholic. I don't want a long story. I don't read that whole thick book. Do you think I'm an alcoholic? And every time I'd ask somebody, they'd start telling me all about themselves. And I think, I didn't really ask if you were alcoholic. I want to know if you think I am. But eventually, what happened for me was, my mom went to a conference in Lubbock, Texas in 1980, and Johnny Harris was a speaker. And she brought back a cassette player and that little cassette, and she put it where she knew, because whenever I was in town and she would, you know, I'd sneak in their house and pass out in the spare bedroom because I knew she'd take care of me. And I had been to a party. My wife kicked me out of the house, and I went over there drunk, and I demanded the couch. So I made everybody get off the couch and drug it outside and threw it over the railing, got it into my truck, drove over to my dad at a little cornfield, and somehow I got it out in the middle of the cornfield, and I sat there and drank whiskey and passed out. And came to just, my mouth's so just dry, and your head just pounding. And it's like, oh my God, and I'm looking at the couch. I don't know how I got the couch. I went in, my mom and dad are at church, and I go into their spare bedroom, and I can't talk much about her because it's just too new. But anyway, there was that cassette player, and there was that cassette, and I have no idea why, but I just stuck it in, and I closed it. And I heard Johnny's talk, and it just started out, and I just heard the first part of it, and he said, a little over 22 and a half years ago, I was crawling down on my hands and knees in solitary confinement. And he said, I was looking for something, and to make matters worse, I didn't know what I was looking for. And I've had that exact same experience, 100%. And I just sat down, and I listened to it, and I just knew that here was a guy that was like me. And he was not only sober, but he had a lot of respect. He had friends. He was involved in his life. And I'm just a 34-year-old loser. I'm a drunk. I don't think I'm a drunk. I'm a gangster. Not a very good one. I'm a bank robber. I'm not a great bank robber, but I'm better than Brian P. Brian P. goes up and demands $50. I knew you could get more than that. I lost a lot of respect for him when I heard that. But hopefully he's got better. But anyway, that was that was my life. Now, I didn't get sober. I mean, but the jig was up. The seed was planted, you know. And I would show up at Alcoholics Anonymous. I liked you. I loved you. It seemed like you could go in there drunk or sober, and I've been there both. And they never kicked me out because I was drunk. You know, they never said, you need to go to a treatment center. They'd just say, come on in, sit down. And if I was too disruptive, a couple of them would call me outside and, try to engage me and talk me down out of the tree and maybe offer you orange juice and honey. Everybody wants that, And I get sober for a while. I got sober one time. I was there sober for, I don't know, seemed like forever, maybe 3 weeks. And I decided to resign from AA, this is just not working for me. So I went in, and we're playing cards again, and I just announced to them, I resign. And they just kind of looked at me, and I went back out and got in the truck, and I spent all day long circling the club, drinking whiskey and listening to AA talks and crying. And then, of course, I pass out in the parking lot. And then, you wake up with that throbbing head, and you're dry, and you just kind of got the shakes. You need water to start with, and then something to drink. And I go into the club to, just to use the restroom. And she said, "There's that smart little SOB that resigned yesterday." just hate them, I'll tell you a little bit about how I got there. Just start waving your hands if I go too long, because I do not want to wind up at On and On Anonymous. I've got enough as it is, I'm the oldest of three children. I was an only child for 7 years, and my mom was 15 when she had me. Started dating my dad when she was 13. He was 19. If they'd done that in this day and age, he'd be in jail and I'd be in child protective services or whatever. But that was a different time. And he was 19, she was 15. They had me. They knew the dirt poor. I mean, it was just unbelievably poor. My folks' first home was a chicken coop. that they cleaned out and wallpapered with a newspaper. When my mother's sister came over to see where they were living, she said, "Well, you've got a phone," because they had a picture of a phone on the newspaper on the wall. So that was impressive, I guess. Anyway, that was the way they were. I mean, they were desperately poor, and they were afraid. My grandmother had died of beriberi in an asylum at 38. My aunt had committed suicide. And my grandfather had just taken off and left the kids. And my dad's side of the family were all like, you know, they were their Church of Christ. Their philosophy was that a praying knee and a dancing foot didn't grow in the same leg. And they were very, very hard people that worked out in the country. My dad was went to the Second World War, when he came back, he was all twisted up, and he was a hard drinker. And we lived in South Texas, and he would come in and take me with him when he'd go out bar hopping. And when he started drinking, he was a lot of fun. I mean, he'd just would come out and play. And he'd take me with him, and I really loved my dad. And I remember playing with him, him playing with me out in the backyard, and throwing me up in the air and catching me and holding me to his bare chest, big, strong man, and just patting my head. And I felt on a very visceral level, I'm just safe. I'm with my dad. Nothing can harm me. My mom was not having the same experience I was. The check was going out the door. My dad's out all night carousing and got her son. And she said, "If you don't quit, I'm going to take Danny and go home." He didn't want to lose his family, so he put the plug in the jug. And I'm telling you, overnight he went from this fun guy that just loved to see me to this angry guy who was explosive, was a workaholic. And I didn't know what was wrong, but everything I did seemed to be wrong. So I grew up seeking my own counsel. I was just like everybody else. I didn't know I probably had the alcoholic gene that ran in our family. But by the time I was in middle school, man, I was a hot mess, and I hadn't had a drink. I went to school one day, and they played a film called Duck and Cover. That's where you go in and you find out what to do in case a nuclear bomb goes off in your neighborhood. And, you know, you just take your biggest book and put it over your head and duck down. I wasn't their best student, and I knew that was woefully inadequate. And I just came out of there and had a meltdown. I started running away. And they brought me back, and, you know, you go to juvenile detention. And then there was a big plane crash over Midland on a clear day. There was 7 or 8 people just fell out of the sky, and right literally over me. And I mean, I just had a meltdown, and nothing seemed to be safe. And I ran, and they brought me back. They put me in a mental institution. I got out of that. This is when I started drinking. I got my mom's car. I wanted to go hang out with some of the cool guys. I took my mother's car. And I drove down there to where all the drive-in restaurant was, where everybody hung out. And, you know, I met the guys, and I was ashamed. I wished I hadn't gone. I felt bad. My head's racing. And a guy offered me a drink. And I don't know when that night it happened, but, man, something spectacular happened that night, because I just hit that zone. I mean, all of a sudden you could just breathe. You know, you just unwind. And I could dance, I could fight, not very well. I chased girls, didn't catch any. I did get my nose broken, and I wrecked my mother's car, and I went to juvenile detention. And other than that, it was a perfect evening. And I came back, and they're having a family meeting. That's where I sit and they talk. And My dad said that, you know, I think he got out of the hospital a little early, so they sent me back to the hospital, and I immediately escaped. And they brought me back and said, "If you do it again, we'll give you shock treatments," and they would have. So I was biding my time, and then one day we were walking to the cafeteria, and there was a lady had left her car running. I mean, is that odd, or is that God? I mean, that was just like... I grabbed my two best friends who were getting shock treatments and said, come on, and we jumped in that car and we took off and we made our way to Midland, which was 38 miles away. And we picked up two more guys who should have been in that hospital. And this was like the most exciting time of my entire existence. I mean, the police are after us, the hospital's looking for us, we're in a stolen car, this is my first gang, I'm their leader. I mean, I have a plan, you know. We're going to Mexico. That's just going to solve everything. So we headed south to Mexico, it's 240 miles, and we don't have any money, but we go into different places and create a diversion so we can steal booze and food and gas. And if you're escaped mental patients, creating a diversion is not that hard. But as we're heading south, those two guys that were with me, their meds began to wear off. And it became clear they were in that hospital for a reason. It became increasingly more difficult for me to gather my gang up and get them back in the car. It was like herding cats, you know. But anyway, we finally made it across the border, and I sold that car to a taxi driver down there in Villacuña for a few hundred pesos. I thought that was a lot of money. It's a big stack, but even in 1962, that's not that much money. But we made it over into Boys Town, and we're sitting there and we're having a drink. And this is when I realized I'm completely out of plan. I have no idea what we're going to do. And all of a sudden, there was this big commotion. And one of the guys that I'd taken with me had a sort of a psychotic break, I guess. And he had killed a parrot that belonged to a girl at work down there. He thought it said something ugly to him, I guess. But anyway... It started a big fight, and here come the federale and the local police, and I grabbed these guys and said, we've got to get back to Texas, and we ran for the international border, but they caught us on the Mexican side, and we went to jail in Mexico. That's what I said. In the big book, in the doctor's opinion, it says that the alcoholic's problems pile up on him and become astonishingly difficult to solve. And this is one of those instances that bore that truth out, because I'm not bilingual. I didn't know how to tell these people I want my mother. But I did. She finally found me and got me out of it. She got me out. She didn't get all of them out because she thought they were a bad influence on me. I often wonder what happened to them. I mean, I wonder if they learned the language or something, you know. But anyway, I'm free, and that's all that matters to me. And we made that trip all the way back to Midland, where she played loud Mexican music and quoted scripture to me. It was her attempt at inversion therapy. And it really works. I still hate that music. We got back to Mexico. We had a family meeting. My dad said he ought to join the Navy. They'll make a man out of him. I wanted to say, I have a bulletin for you. I'm an escaped mental patient. But apparently it didn't matter to the Navy at all. The day I turned 17, I joined the Navy. They put me in the CVs. I joined a construction battalion, and I island hopped across the Pacific. I was a two-fisted drinker. I mean, I could drink people under the table. It just was amazing, and I loved it. I lived for going out after work and having a good time. I loved being in the military. I loved having a uniform. I liked everything except getting up early and being told what to do. But I'm starting to have these episodes where I just forget. I don't know what happened. Everybody leaves and I'm still there, or everybody's there and I'm gone, and I don't know what happened. And it's very disturbing, and you can't tell anybody. I don't know what happened. I don't know why I'm downtown at Gagne Guam and everybody else is back at the barracks. I don't, you know, because I was with them. And so I keep that to myself. And the other thing that's happening is that I'm drinking now, and sometimes I'm having a good time, but sometimes, you know, I get really angry, you know, I start fights and I get in trouble.
Sometimes I break down and cry. And I'm feeling more and more isolated and less wanting to be a part of anything. I think everybody's talking about me, you know? I mean, it's the damnedest thing. You know, probably nobody even knew I was there. And what happened finally is I got drunk with some British sailors at a local club. And after they closed the club, they invited me to their vessel because they had, back in those days, they had liquor rations. And I went aboard their vessel and passed out, and they went to sea. this was kind of a big deal for them. And they, they have muster, and it turns out they have too many sailors. And it was pretty easy to figure out who wasn't British. And we're not that far out. I mean, they bring a launch in, and the shore patrol come and get me and bring me back. I go to the brig, and, you know, another captain's mast. But I'm humiliated. That's funny now, but it wasn't funny then. I mean, I never intended for something like that to happen. I was a good electrician. I really was a patriotic guy. I had my sights set on becoming a first class petty officer and being, you know, getting into A school, B school, C school, all that. I wanted to do that. But I can't do anything. I mean, nothing that I'm doing achieves any goal that I'm headed for. Everything that I think I want, I can't do. All I can do is dream about it. And I got back to the States. I went AWOL. I didn't intend to go AWOL. I guess I just wanted to go to Texas, and that's a problem. And they brought me back, and just on and on. It goes down, and I finally got a general discharge under honorable conditions after 2.5 years in the military because they found out I was, you know, they had a fruitcake. And I wound up on Skid Row, and I spent a lot of time on Skid Row. Being downtown L.A. is a beast. It's very hard to get out of. And I would try everything under the sun to get away. And I'd call my mom, and she'd send me money, and I'd be so relieved, you know, I'm finally getting out of it, that I'd have a drink. And then the money's gone. And then I'm selling blood, and then I'm selling plasma, then I'm hustling and stealing. I'm lying and cheating, stealing. Somebody turned me on to an amphetamines, and I found out that now that you don't necessarily have to black out, but you're going to talk to everybody all the time. And if they don't want to talk to you, just go talk anyway. And I finally got out of downtown. I remember when the last time that I got money to get away, I was so relieved because I've been down there for weeks. And I was walking to the bus station, and I was going to go to work for my dad. I'm going to straighten up. I got this. And I walked by a bar, and they had the door open to the bar, and there was music playing, and they had this rolling pleated red plastic. Looked like leather, but it's plastic. And there was a smoky mirror behind the bar. And as I walked by, I thought, I want a Manhattan. I don't even know what a Manhattan is. But I went in and I ordered a Manhattan, and I came out about 3 or 4 in the morning. I'm broke. I got no place to go. I had no intention of doing that. But eventually I got out and I got back to West Texas. My dad had an electrical company. I tried to work for him. I'm a great electrician. But I'm full-blown alcoholic. I got problems, and I create problems wherever I go. So my dad fired me, and I started hanging out on another side of town, and I met some guys who were stealing out of the oil field, and they had guns and cars and, you know, girlfriends, and they drank Crown Royal, and, you know, they had everything, and I couldn't do anything. So I started hanging with them, and pretty soon I got a gun, a girlfriend, a car, and I drank Crown Royal, and I think, well, everybody's got to be something. I'm a gangster, and I'm good with that. In about 6 months of that, the Texas Rangers showed up, and they arrested everybody, and everyone went to prison except for me. I got a probation, and they told me, if you'll just try to live down the terms of your parole, of your probation, this will be expunged from your record. It'll be a tough lesson. I wanted that more than anything else in the world. I didn't want to sit there. I had been in there for 6 months, and I was like, this is it. I'm going to give my life to the Lord. I'm going to be all right. My folks believe me. I believe me. I got out, it lasted 3 weeks. 3 weeks, I'm there I go. And I wound up in Dallas. I finally got busted. I got 13 five-year sentences. I was sent off to Texas Department of Corrections, and they were running concurrently, thank God. And what I can tell you about being in the prison in the 60s in Texas, it was very time-consuming. And you know, I got out. When I got out, my mom come to get me. I'm going to be better. I get out. So, you know, I'm on the way home. I'm just drinking a little whiskey, and I hit that sweet spot. And I'm just happy. I'm out. I'm going to start a new life. My mom said, "Son, what you need is a wife, kid, a car, a bank account, a job, and a house, and you'll be okay." So I went looking for a woman that had kids, a bank account, a job, and a car. And I found her. I married her, and my mother was wrong. It was the worst 2 weeks of my life. I left her, and I started hanging out in a bar, and I met another girl, and she and I, we fell in love that night. And she was crying, found out she was pregnant, couldn't go home because her folks wouldn't let her come home as an unwed mother. So we decided we'd get married. In Texas, you have to wait 3 days. They want to be sure that it's real love. So we waited our 3 days. I called my mom. We actually were drunk when we got married. And called my mom, collect from the courthouse. I said, "Mom, I'm married." And she said, "I know." And I said, "I don't know how you could. I just did it." She said, "Oh, my God, Danny, you have a wife." And I was like, details. I'm always being tripped up with details. And I'm the kind of guy that would shoot arrows into a wall and then go paint bullseyes around them. And then just back up and congratulate myself on being a good shot, you know. And so I come up with a plan, and we decide to go on our honeymoon. We get on a bus and we go this 400-mile ride to McAlester, Oklahoma, where my new father-in-law picks us up. We go to his house. I pass out. I come up and I go outside to use, smoke a cigarette. And I looked out across a huge yard, and I saw McAlester State Penitentiary. And I had married the warden of McAlester State Penitentiary's daughter. So I was very uncomfortable in that relationship. So I absconded. That means to move in a secret way. And about this time, my life took a turn for the worse. And I was doing pretty good up till now. I got married again. I got to the Nomads, got married again. This girl, I loved this girl. She loved me. I loved her. You don't usually fall in love at that level until you get to a treatment center. This was the real deal. You know what I mean? We lasted about 3 years, but my drinking progressed, and I become violent. She had to leave me because she just had to take care of herself, and I was dangerous to be around. And she was killed in a car wreck. And I did the only thing I knew to do. I got a bottle and a gun, and I went on a crime spree, and I got 10 years in penitentiary. And all that progresses. I get out of penitentiary, I married a bartender, you know. I went out. I knew I couldn't be single. I mean, my mom had embedded that in my thought process. I went out looking for her. I found her. She's dancing on top of a table. And I knew that's my wife, you know. And that's when I needed Al-Anon, because she carried out the trash and be gone 3 days. You know? The women all laugh that men don't. It ain't that funny, is it? But she was the one I was married to when I finally started hitting the bottom and coming to Alcoholics Anonymous, and I wound up doing what I told you, all the things that happened. And I came to Austin, Texas, and you know, I'm going to AA there, and I'm cornered, and I'm sweating bullets. I got problems I can't even tell you. I mean, I would come in and they'd say, "You know, just come on in, son, and sit down and let's talk. You'll join AA. do what we do, and your life will turn around. And I was like, if I were an alcoholic, that'd be great. But I'm not. I'm a mental patient. I'm a drug addict. I'm a, you know, a divorcee. I'm a electric. I'm everything, but I'm not alcoholic. And, you know, I didn't understand that if you're going to do something about your drinking, you're going to have to do something about your drinking. I did something about everything else. And I'm sitting here and I'm out of game. I got no plan. I'm in a stolen car. I'm on parole. I haven't reported to my parole officer in 2 years because I didn't have anything good to report. And I do not like to see people disappointed, you know. So, I mean, my back's to the wall. And I'm going to AA, and everybody's always getting a sponsor. I thought get a sponsor means like me. Get a sponsor. Be my sponsor. That means I'm lonely. Will you be my friend? That's what it really meant to me. I would, you know, you would talk, and I'd like the way you talk, and I think that sounds so cool. And I would ask you to sponsor me, and then you'd want me to do something. Well, I didn't want that kind of relationship. I just wanted to. So I'm not getting anywhere in AA, you know. I've learned prayers. I've learned, you know, who's cool and who's not. I know where all the fun people go. And the older people, they just sit there and look at you and you think, who wants to be around them? Happy joys and free my butt, you know. And I went to a meeting, and it was a terrible meeting. And the only reason I went is because I didn't have any place to live. I'm living in that car. And I left that meeting angry, and I drove away, and I thought I needed some cigarettes. And I had a carton of cigarettes in the back seat. But I pulled into a service station, went in, came out with a six-pack of beer. And I went on my last drug. I came to in a rough part of town with three old Milwaukee beers left, and I was puking blood and bile. And I just said, God, I'd do anything if I could just get sober. And two guys came to get me from the club. And on the way back, I'm riding that car. This guy, John Henry, who became my sponsor, I'm riding with him. And I said, John, what am I going to do? He said, Danny, if you don't drink, you won't get drunk. I said, how the hell do you do that? He said, well, don't drink right now. And then when it's right now again, don't drink then either. And that kid was with him, said, yeah, but pretty soon you'll have like a minute. And John said, you know, don't pay any attention to him. He said, listen, minutes become hours, weeks, months, years. You join us in this thing we do, and you'll find yourself a sober, self-respecting member of Alcoholics Anonymous with a relationship with the power that runs this universe and a host of friends. And I'm telling you, drunk on the way to that club, I was smitten with a magnificent obsession for sobriety. I wanted to be with you and like you more than anything else in the world. And I started going to that club. I slept in that car, and I'd go to places to clean up public restrooms, and I'd come in the morning and help them set up. And pretty soon those old guys were saying, you're doing good, kid. And they'd give me cassettes to listen to, and they gave me a big book. And I just remember one hot August riding around thinking, they're always saying let go and let God. And I thought, what? Let go and let God do what? And then I thought, John Henry will know. And I went back to the club, and he was standing outside, and I walked up to him, and I said, John Henry, I'm an alcoholic. He said, yeah, you are. He said, come on in this house. And I came inside, and he went back to one of those little rooms that we had set up for doing fifth step things, and he just came in, and he told me about himself, and he listened to me, and we got on our knees, and we said a prayer. And he said, son, you don't have any time to waste. He said, you need to write now. I checked into a Motel 6, and I wrote and wrote and wrote, and had several pages. I hid it all over that old car because I was afraid somebody would find it. And I found John Henry, and I said, will you listen to my inventory? And he said, somebody's going to have to, or you're going to die. And I did that. And he said, now I want you to go down to Town Lake, and I want you to think about what you've just done. And are you willing to do this? Because if you want to live the way you live, you don't need any help. He said, but if you want what we have, we can't help a guy in the shape that you're in. He said, you're beyond human aid. You will absolutely have to have a spiritual experience. And when I got down to that lake, I stepped out of that car, I felt this power just wash over me and through me, and it just stayed with me forever. And I thought, I'm free, I'll never have to drink again. I was elated. I was amazed before I was halfway through. I thought sobriety was, I'm going to get free and I'm going to be okay. I didn't know sobriety was about me and you. I didn't know that sobriety included you, or I would have no sobriety at all. So I'm at this point, this is as far as I'm going to go. My life is too convoluted. My past is too bad to address. The best thing is, let's just push it over here and move forward. And man, I'm involved in AA. I'm 12-stepping fool. I got nothing to say, but I'm going to tell you what. I'll come get you. I'll tell you, this is the hot thing to do. And I'm doing all that, and about 6 months in, I just started having a meltdown. My head's racing, my foot's patting, I got a knot in my gut. I called John. I said, I can't stay. This doesn't work for me. He said, meet me at the club. And I met him at the club, and he said, Danny, what's standing between you and that God that you experience are the things that are on your 8-step list. I said, well, there's some things I didn't tell you. He said, well, what are they? I said, well, I live in a stolen car. He said, that's a problem. And in the summer of 1980, there was a bank robbery in San Angelo, Texas. And they have it on videotape. It's my M.O. I'm in the area, and I'm a blackout drinker. I have no clue, but they want me. He said, well, you got to go in and clean that up. I said, oh, no. He said, you told me when we started this that you were willing to go to any length to have this gift. I said, that's serious. This is serious. They're going to lock me up the rest of my life. He said, well, get a new sponsor, son, because you will not make it with that. And I don't sponsor drunks. And he left, and I sat out in that car, and I said, well, I'm screwed. I said, God, I'm too afraid. I want to, but I'm just too afraid. If you want me to do it, you'll have to help me. And almost immediately, I got this epiphany, this comfort, that four walls do not make a prison. Prison is something you carry around on the inside of you. And I had the keys to the kingdom. I had a choice. I could run, or I could be willing to sacrifice my physical freedom to have what you have. And I just knew I was going to be able to do it. The next morning I got up and went down to the robbery department. I parked that car a long ways away. And I walked up there, and I went in and I told them who I was. And they took me upstairs. I told him all about my good work in AA. And he played that. He had a copy of that. He played that little video. It was just about 15 seconds long. And I watched it. And he was a tall, skinny guy with a beard and cowboy hat and a gun. And I watched it about 15 seconds long. And watched it twice. And the second time, I just sunk inside. And I thought, I wonder what I did with the money. I'm so screwed. And he turned around and looked at me and he said, the guy I'm looking for wouldn't walk in here. He said, the guy I'm looking for is out there and we'll find him. But you need to get your skinny butt back to AA and maybe you can do something about the mess you've created. I said, I'm in AA forever. I'm not afraid to make amends anymore. I'll make yours, you know. And that began my journey in AA. And I had old ideas attached because from all day one, I come from a broken, you know, from a family that was broken spiritually and emotionally. And I've been through all these things. I got all these black marks on me. You know, like, how am I ever going to have anything, do anything, be anything? You know, all I can be is maybe cut your lawn. And John Henry said, you're not an ex-convict. You're not an ex-mental person. What you are is a child of God, a member of Alcoholics Anonymous, with a message you carry. You trust God, reach for the stars. If you're supposed to get it, God will make sure that that happens. He said, I guarantee you one thing. If you walk around expecting disaster, that's what you'll get. You expect a miracle. We write it on the walls. He said, we mean what we say up there. We don't put stuff up in AA just for, you know, something cute to say. That big book is a guide to living. Every answer that you need is there. I got involved with a girl. You would be surprised. And I told my story. I'll make this really quick, but I told my story at a treatment center, and she was there, and we connected. So I checked her out, and I'm kind of lover and sponsor, and it didn't go well. And I'd gotten a new sponsor. I'd moved to Midland, and she was with me. And finally, it just got so bad that she got a free bed back in another treatment center. And I went to my sponsor, and he said, "Son, do not call her." He said, "The first phone call will make you sick." And I said, "What do I do?" He said, "You bring that book, and you come with me, and we're gonna start helping these other guys." I said, "What good is that going to do?" He said, "When your house is on fire, mow your neighbor's lawn. Remember that. Your house is on fire, mow your neighbor's lawn. It'll make a difference." I said, "That's stupid. The house is on fire. Did you get that?" And he said, "Just do what I ask you to do." And I started going with Harold everywhere, but I got to worrying about how well she was doing, so I called her. And I asked her how she was doing, and she said, "Oh, she's doing fabulous," which I didn't like to hear. And she said, "We're going on nature walks. We're doing inner child work. They've got we got teddy bears back then. They're doing all kinds of things." And I'm listening. I'm thinking, "See, Harold and I, we're not doing any of that." And she said, "What are you doing?" I said, "Well, I'm going a lot of 12-step calls with Harold, meeting with him, reading that book. I'm trying to learn to do 86, 87, and 88. And I'm just going to a lot of meetings. I'm trying to learn about how to make that book my way." And she said, "Well, we think a lot of people are hiding in that big book." And I thought about it, and I said, "Screw you." And I hung up the phone, and I called Harold, which he's about my age now, and this was about 10:30 at night. And he answered the phone, and I said, "Harold, what are you doing?" He said, "Oh, Olivia and I were just laying here waiting for your phone call." I told him what I had done, and I told him what she said. And he said, "Well, me boy, if you're a drunk like me, there ain't no safer place in the world to hide." He said, "I've been hiding there for 26 years, and that bottle hasn't found me yet. I sleep easy at night." And I thought, I wonder why I didn't think of that. Because I would call him up, and he'd say, "Dan Brown, avoid the deliberate manufacture of misery. But when trouble comes along, cheerfully capitalize it as an opportunity to demonstrate his omnipotence." That is so cool. He said, "Read the books up." And eventually I found that everything he was saying to me was in there, and that I could carry him around with me because he was an embodiment of what that book is. I am so, so grateful to be sober. I'm so grateful that when my parents both died, I was here and I was sober. And I've got a good life. I own a little company. I've been through, just like you, I've been through some good days and some bad days, but they've all been aware days. I'm all here. Some days I'm a little more here than I want to be. But God is good. God is so good. And I didn't think that I could ever get rid of my old ideas about Him, but I've come to believe that God is all in my corner. He just wants me to do the best thing. Ride the horse in the direction it's going, because He's guiding it, and I'm glad to be here. God bless you. Thanks.